Chapter 9. The Man in the Mist. Tommy was not pleased with life. Blunt's brilliant detectives had met with a reverse, distressing to their pride, if not to their pockets. Called in professionally to elucidate the mystery of a stolen pearl necklace at Adlington Hall, Adlington, Blunt's brilliant detectives had failed to make good. Whilst Tommy, hard on the track of a gambling countess, was tracking her in the guise of a Roman Catholic priest, and Tuppence was getting off with the nephew of the house on the golf links, the local inspector of police had unemotionally arrested the second footman, who proved to be a thief well known at headquarters and who admitted his guilt without making any bones about it. Tommy and Tuppence, therefore, had withdrawn with what dignity they could muster and were at the present moment solacing themselves with cocktails at the Grand Adlington Hotel. Tommy still wore his clerical disguise. "Hardly a Father Brown touch that," he remarked gloomily. "And yet, I've got just the right kind of umbrella." "It wasn't a Father Brown problem," said Tuppence. "One needs a certain atmosphere from the start. One must be doing something quite ordinary, and then bizarre things begin to happen. That's the idea."
"Unfortunately," said Tommy, "we have to return to town. Perhaps something bizarre will happen on the way to the station."
He raised the glass he was holding to his lips, but the liquid in it was suddenly spilled as a heavy hand smacked him on the shoulder, and a voice to match the hand boomed out words of greeting.
"Upon my soul, it is! Old Tommy! And Mrs. Tommy, too! Where did you blow in from? Haven't seen or heard anything of you for years!" "Why, it's Bulger," said Tommy, setting down what was left of the cocktail and turning to look at the intruder, a big, square-shouldered man of 30 years of age, with a round, red, beaming face, and dressed in golfing kit. "Good old Bulger! But I say, old chap," said Bulger, whose real name, by the way, was Marvin Estcourt, "I never knew you'd taken orders. Fancy you a blinking parson!"
Tuppence burst out laughing, and Tommy looked embarrassed, and then they suddenly became conscious of a fourth person. A tall, slender creature with very golden hair and very round blue eyes, almost impossibly beautiful, with an effect of really expensive black topped by wonderful ermines and very large pearl earrings. She was smiling, and her smile said many things. It asserted, for instance, that she knew perfectly well that she herself was the best thing worth looking at, certainly in England, and possibly in the whole world. She was not vain about it in any way, but she just knew, with certainty and confidence, that it was so. Both Tommy and Tuppence recognized her immediately. They had seen her 3 times in The Secret of the Heart, and an equal number of times in that other great success, Pillars of Fire, and in innumerable other plays. There was perhaps no other actress in England who had so firm a hold on the British public as Miss Gilda Glenn. She was reported to be the most beautiful woman in England. It was also rumoured that she was the stupidest.
Old friends of mine, Miss Glenn," said Estcourt,
with a tinge of apology in his voice for having presumed, even for a moment, to forget such a radiant creature.
Tommy and Mrs. Tommy, let me introduce you to Miss Gilda Glenn."
The ring of pride in his voice was unmistakable. By merely being seen in his company, Miss Glenn had conferred great glory upon him. The actress was staring with frank interest at Tommy.
"Are you really a priest?" she asked. "A Roman Catholic priest, I mean? Because I thought they didn't have wives."
Estcourt went off in a boom of laughter again.
"Oh, that's good," he exploded. "You sly dog, Tommy. Glad he hasn't renounced you, Mrs. Tommy, with all the rest of the pomps and vanities."
Gilda Glenn took not the faintest notice of him. She continued to stare at Tommy with puzzled eyes.
"Are you a priest?" she demanded.
"Very few of us are what we seem to be," said Tommy gently. "My profession is not unlike that of a priest. I don't give absolution, but I listen to confessions. I—"
"Don't you listen to him," interrupted Estcourt. "He's pulling your leg."
"If you're not a clergyman, I don't see why you're dressed up like one," she puzzled. "That is, unless—"
"Not a criminal flying from justice," said Tommy. "The other thing."
"Oh."
She frowned and looked at him with beautiful, bewildered eyes.
I wonder if she'll ever get that, thought Tommy to himself. Not unless I put it in words of one syllable for her, I should say. Aloud, he said, Know anything about trains back to town, Bulger? We've got to be pushing for home. How far is it to the station?
Oh, 10 minutes walk. But no hurry. Next train up is the 6:35, and it's only about 20 to 6 now. You've just missed one.
Which way is it to the station from here?
Sharp to the left when you turn out of the hotel, then, let me see. Down Morgan's Avenue would be the best way, wouldn't it?
Morgan's Avenue? Miss Glenn started violently and stared at him with startled eyes.
I know what you're thinking of, said Estcourt, laughing. The ghost! Morgan's Avenue is bounded by the cemetery on one side, and tradition has it that a policeman who met his death by violence gets up and walks on his old beat, up and down Morgan's Avenue. A spook policeman, can you beat it? But lots of people swear to having seen him.
A policeman? Said Miss Glenn. She shivered a little. But there aren't really any ghosts, are there? I mean, there aren't such things. She got up, folding her wrap tighter round her. Goodbye, she said vaguely. She had ignored Tuppence completely throughout, and now she did not even glance in her direction. But over her shoulder, she threw one puzzled, questioning glance at Tommy. Just as she got to the door, she encountered a tall man with grey hair and a puffy face, who uttered an exclamation of surprise. His hand on her arm, he led her through the doorway, talking in an animated fashion.
Beautiful creature, isn't she? Said Estcourt. Brains of a rabbit. Rumour has it that she's going to marry Lord Leconbury. That was Leconbury in the doorway.
He doesn't look a very nice sort of man to marry, remarked Tuppence. Estcourt shrugged his shoulders.
A title has a kind of glamour still, I suppose, he said. And Leconbury is not an impoverished peer by any means. She'll be in clover. Nobody knows where she sprang from. Pretty near the gutter, I dare say. There's something deuced mysterious about her being down here anyway. She's not staying at the hotel. When I tried to find out where she was staying, she snubbed me, quite crudely, in the only way she knows. Best if I know what it's all about.
He glanced at his watch and uttered an exclamation.
I must be off. Jolly glad to have seen you two again. Must have a bust in town together some night. So long!
He hurried away, and as he did so, a page approached with a note on a salver. The note was unaddressed. But it's for you, sir, he said to Tommy, from Miss Gilda Glenn. Tommy tore it open and read it with some curiosity. Inside were a few lines written in a straggling, untidy hand. I'm not sure, but I think you might be able to help me. And you'll be going that way to the station. Could you be at the White House, Morgan's Avenue, at 6:10? Yours sincerely, Gilda Glenn. Tommy nodded to the page, who departed, and then handed the note to Tuppence.
Extraordinary, said Tuppence. Is it because she still thinks you're a priest?
No, said Tommy thoughtfully. I should say it's because she's at last taken in that I'm not one. Hello, what's this? This was a young man with flaming red hair, a pugnacious jaw, and appallingly shabby clothes. He had walked into the room and was now striding up and down, muttering to himself.
Hell! Said the red-haired man loudly and forcibly. That's what I say! Hell!
He dropped into a chair near the young couple and stared at them moodily.
Damn all women, that's what I say, said the young man, eyeing Tuppence ferociously. Oh, all right. Kick up a row if you like. Have me turned out of the hotel. It won't be the first time. Why shouldn't we say what we think? Why should we go about bottling up our feelings and smirking and saying things exactly like everyone else? I don't feel pleasant and polite. I feel like getting hold of someone round the throat and gradually choking them to death. He paused.
Any particular person? Asked Tuppence.
Or just anybody?
One particular person, said the young man grimly.
Oh, this is very interesting, said Tuppence. Won't you tell us some more?
My name's Riley, said the red-haired man. James Riley. You may have heard it. I wrote a little volume of pacifist poems. Good stuff, although I say so.
Pacifist poems? Said Tuppence.
Yes. Why not? Demanded Mr. Riley belligerently.
Oh, nothing,
said Tuppence hastily.
I'm for peace all the time, said Mr. Riley fiercely. To hell with war and women! Women! Did you see that creature who was trailing around here just now? Gilda Glenn, she calls herself. Gilda Glenn. God!
How I've worshipped that woman. And I'll tell you this. If she's got a heart at all, it's on my side. She cared once for me, and I could make her care again. And if she sells herself to that muck-heap Leckenbury, well, God help her. I'd as soon kill her with my own hands. And on this, suddenly he rose and rushed from the room. Tommy raised his eyebrows. A somewhat excitable gentleman, he murmured. Well, Tuppence, shall we start? A fine mist was coming up as they emerged from the hotel into the cool outer air. Obeying Estcourt's directions, they turned sharp to the left, and in a few minutes they came to a turning labelled Morgan's Avenue. The mist had increased. It was soft and white, and hurried past them in little eddying drifts. To their left was the high wall of the cemetery, on their right a row of small houses. Presently these ceased, and a high hedge took their place. Tommy, said Tuppence, I'm beginning to feel jumpy. The mist, and the silence, as though we were miles from anywhere. One does feel like that, agreed Tommy. All alone in the world. It's the effect of the mist, and not being able to see ahead of one. Tuppence nodded. Just our footsteps echoing on the pavement. What's that?
What's what?
I thought I heard other footsteps behind us. You'll be seeing the ghost in a minute if you work yourself up like this, said Tommy kindly. Don't be so nervy. Are you afraid the spook policeman will lay his hands on your shoulder? Tuppence emitted a shrill squeal. Don't, Tommy. Now you've put it in my head. She craned her head back over her shoulder, trying to peer into the white veil that was wrapped all round them. There they are again, she whispered. No, they're in front now. Tommy, don't say you can't hear them.
I do hear something. Yes, it's footsteps behind us. Somebody else walking this way to catch the train. I wonder.
He stopped suddenly and stood still, and Tuppence gave a gasp, for the curtain of mist in front of them suddenly parted in the most artificial manner, and there, not 20 feet away, a gigantic policeman suddenly appeared as though materialized out of the fog. One minute he was not there, the next minute he was. So at least it seemed to the rather superheated imaginations of the two watchers. Then, as the mist rolled back still more, a little scene appeared, as though set on a stage. The big blue policeman, a scarlet pillar box, and on the right of the road, the outlines of a white house. Red, white, and blue, said Tommy. It's damn pictorial. Come on, Tuppence. There's nothing to be afraid of. For, as he had already seen, the policeman was a real policeman, and moreover, he was not nearly so gigantic as he had at first seemed, looming up out of the mist. But as they started forward, footsteps came from behind them. A man passed them, hurrying along. He turned in at the gate of the White House, ascended the steps, and beat a deafening tattoo upon the knocker. He was admitted just as they reached the spot where the policeman was standing, staring after him.
There's a gentleman seems to be in a hurry, commented the policeman. He spoke in a slow, reflective voice, as one whose thoughts took some time to mature.
He's the sort of gentleman always would be in a hurry, remarked Tommy. The policeman's stare, slow and rather suspicious, came round to rest on his face.
Friend of yours? He demanded,
and there was distinct suspicion now in his voice.
No, said Tommy. He's not a friend of mine, but I happen to know who he is. Name of Riley.
Ah, said the policeman.
Well, I'd better be getting along.
Can you tell me where the White House is? Asked Tommy. The constable jerked his head sideways.
This is it. Mrs. Honeycutt's.
He paused and added, evidently with the idea of giving them valuable information.
Nervous party. Always suspecting burglars is around. Always asking me to have a look around the place. Middle-aged women get like that.
Middle-aged, eh? Said Tommy. Do you happen to know if there's a young lady staying there?
A young lady? Said the policeman, ruminating. A young lady? No, I can't say I know anything about that.
Well, she mayn't be staying here, Tommy, said Tuppence. And anyway, she mayn't be here yet. She could only have started just before we did.
Ah, said the policeman suddenly.
Now that I call it to mind, a young lady did go into this gate. I saw her. As I was coming up the road, about 3 or 4 minutes ago, it might be.
With ermine furs on? Asked Tuppence eagerly.
She had some kind of white rabbit round her throat, admitted the policeman. Tuppence smiled. The policeman went on in the direction from which they had just come, and they prepared to enter the gate of the White House. Suddenly, a faint, muffled cry sounded from inside the house, and almost immediately afterwards the front door opened, and James Riley came rushing down the steps. His face was white and twisted, and his eyes glared in front of him unseeingly. He staggered like a drunken man. He passed Tommy and Tuppence as though he did not see them, muttering to himself with a kind of dreadful repetition, "My God! My God! Oh, my God!" He clutched at the gatepost as though to steady himself, and then, as though animated by sudden panic, he raced off down the road as hard as he could go in the opposite direction from that taken by the policeman. Tommy and Tuppence stared at each other in bewilderment.
"Well," said Tommy, "something's happened in that house to scare our friend Riley pretty badly."
Tuppence drew her finger absently across the gatepost. "He must have put his hand on some wet red paint somewhere," she said idly.
"Hmm," said Tommy. "I think we'd better go inside rather quickly. I don't understand this business."
In the doorway of the house, a white-capped maidservant was standing almost speechless with indignation.
"Did you ever see the likes of that now, father?" she burst out as Tommy ascended the steps. "That fella comes here, asks for the young lady, rushes upstairs without how or by your leave. She lets out a screech like a wild cat, and what wonder, poor pretty dear, and straight away he comes rushing down again with the white face on him like one who's seen a ghost. What will be the meaning of it all?"
"Who are you talking with at the front door, Ellen?"
demanded a sharp voice from the interior of the hall.
"Here's Mrs.," said Ellen, somewhat unnecessarily.
She drew back, and Tommy found himself confronting a grey-haired, middle-aged woman with frosty blue eyes imperfectly concealed by pince-nez, and a spare figure clad in black, with bugle trimming.
"A Mrs. Honeycott," said Tommy. "I came here to see Miss Glenn."
Mrs. Honeycott gave him a sharp glance, then went on to Tuppence, and took in every detail of her appearance.
"Oh, you did you?" she said. "Well, you'd better come inside."
She led the way into the hall, and along it, into a room at the back of the house facing on the garden. It was a fair-sized room, but looked smaller than it was, owing to the large amount of chairs and tables crowded into it. A big fire burned in the grate, and a chintz-covered sofa stood at one side of it. The wallpaper was a small grey stripe with a festoon of roses around the top. Quantities of engravings and oil paintings covered the walls. It was a room almost impossible to associate with the expensive personality of Miss Gilda Glenn.
"Sit down," said Mrs. Honeycott. "To begin with, you'll excuse me if I say I don't hold with the Roman Catholic religion. Never did I think to see a Roman Catholic priest in my house. But if Gilda's gone over to the Scarlet Woman, it's only what's to be expected in a life like hers, and I dare say it might be worse. She mightn't have any religion at all. I should think more of Roman Catholics if their priests were married. I always speak my mind. And to think of those convents, quantities of beautiful young girls shut up there and no one knowing what becomes of them. Well, it won't bear thinking about."
Mrs. Honeycott came to a full stop and drew a deep breath. Without entering upon a defence of the celibacy of the priesthood or the other controversial points touched upon, Tommy went straight to the point.
"I understand, Mrs. Honeycott, that Miss Glenn is in this house."
"She is. Mind you, I don't approve. Marriage is marriage, and your husband's your husband. As you make your bed, so you must lie on it."
I don't quite understand," began Tommy, bewildered. "I thought as much. That's the reason I brought you in here. You can go up to Gilda after I've spoken my mind. She came to me, after all these years, think of it, and asked me to help her, wanted me to see this man and persuade him to agree to a divorce. I told her straight out I'd have nothing whatever to do with it. Divorce is sinful. But I couldn't refuse my own sister shelter in my house, could I now?"
"Your sister?" exclaimed Tommy.
"Yes. Gilda's my sister.
Didn't she tell you?"
Tommy stared at her open-mouthed. The thing seemed fantastically impossible. Then he remembered that the angelic beauty of Gilda Glenn had been in evidence for many years. He had been taken to see her act as quite a small boy.
"Yes.
It was possible, after all. But what a piquant contrast. So it was from this lower middle-class respectability that Gilda Glen had sprung. How well she had guarded her secret. "I'm not yet quite clear," he said. "Your sister is married?" "Ran away to be married as a girl of 17," said Mrs. Honeycott succinctly. "Some common fellow far below her in station, and our father a reverend. It was a disgrace. Then she left her husband and went on the stage. Play-acting. I've never been inside a theatre in my life. I hold no truck with wickedness. Now, after all these years, she wants to divorce the man. Means to marry some bigwig, I suppose. But her husband's standing firm. Not to be bullied, and not to be bribed. I admire him for it."
"What's his name?" asked Tommy suddenly.
"That's an extraordinary thing now, but I can't remember. It's nearly 20 years ago, you know, since I heard it. My father forbade it to be mentioned, and I've refused to discuss the matter with Gilda. She knows what I think, and that's enough for her."
"It wasn't Riley, was it?"
"It might have been, I really can't say. It's gone clean out of my head. The man, I mean, was here just now."
"Well, that man?
I thought he was an escaped lunatic. I'd been in the kitchen giving orders to Ellen. I just got back into this room, and was wondering whether Gilda had come in yet. She has a latchkey, when I heard her. She hesitated a minute or two in the hall, and then went straight upstairs. About 3 minutes later, all this tremendous rat-tatting began. I went out into the hall, and just saw a man rushing upstairs. Then there was a sort of cry upstairs, and presently Diary came again and rushed out like a madman. Pretty goings-on."
Tommy rose.
"Mrs. Honeycott, let us go upstairs at once. I am afraid—"
"What of?"
"Afraid that you have no red wet paint in the house." Mrs. Honeycott stared at him.
"Well, of course I haven't."
"That is what I feared," said Tommy gravely. "Please let us go to your sister's room at once."
Momentarily silenced, Mrs. Honeycott led the way. They caught a glimpse of Ellen in the hall, backing hastily into one of the rooms. Mrs. Honeycott opened the first door at the top of the stairs. Tommy and Tuppence entered close behind her. Suddenly she gave a gasp and fell back. A motionless figure in black and ermine lay stretched on the sofa. The face was untouched, a beautiful, soulless face like a mature child asleep. The wound was on the side of the head. A heavy blow with some blunt instrument had crushed in the skull. Blood was dripping slowly onto the floor, but the wound itself had long ceased to bleed. Tommy examined the prostrate figure, his face very white. "So," he said at last, "he didn't strangle her after all."
"What do you mean? Who?" cried Mrs. Honeycott. Is she dead?"
"Oh yes, Mrs. Honeycott, she's dead. Murdered. The question is, by whom? Not that it is much of a question. Funny, for all his ranting words, I didn't think the fellow had got it in him." He paused a minute, then turned to Tuppence with decision. "Will you go out and get a policeman, or ring up the police station from somewhere?" Tuppence nodded. She too was very white. Tommy led Mrs. Honeycott downstairs again.
"I don't want there to be any mistake about this," he said. "Do you know exactly what time it was when your sister came in?"
"Yes, I do," said Mrs. Honeycott. "Because I was just setting the clock on 5 minutes, as I have to do every evening. It loses just 5 minutes a day. It was exactly 6:08 by my watch, and that never loses or gains a second."
Tommy nodded. That agreed perfectly with the policeman's story. He had seen the woman with the white furs go in at the gate. Probably 3 minutes had elapsed before he and Tuppence had reached the same spot. He had glanced at his own watch then and had noted that it was just 1 minute after the time of their appointment. There was just the faint chance that someone might have been waiting for Gilda Glen in the room upstairs, but if so, he must still be hiding in the house. No one but James Riley had left it. He ran upstairs and made a quick but efficient search of the premises, but there was no one concealed anywhere. Then he spoke to Ellen. After breaking the news to her, and waiting for her first lamentations and invocations to the saints to have exhausted themselves, he asked a few questions. Had anyone else come to the house that afternoon asking for Miss Glen? No one whatsoever. Had she herself been upstairs at all that evening?
Yes, she had gone up at 6 o'clock as usual to draw the curtains, or it might have been a few minutes after six. Anyway, it was just before that wild fellow came breaking the knocker down. She'd run downstairs to answer the door, and him a black-hearted murderer all the time. Tommy let it go at that. But he still felt a curious pity for Riley, an unwillingness to believe the worst of him. And yet there was no one else who could have murdered Gilda Glen. Mrs. Honeycott and Ellen had been the only two people in the house. He heard voices in the hall and went to find Tuppence and the policeman from the beat outside. The latter had produced a notebook and a rather blunt pencil, which he licked surreptitiously. He went upstairs and surveyed the victim stolidly, merely remarking that if he was to touch anything, the inspector would give him beans. He listened to all Mrs. Honeycott's hysterical outbursts and confused explanations, and occasionally he wrote something down. His presence was calming and soothing. Tommy finally got him alone for a minute or two on the steps outside ere he departed to telephone headquarters. "Look here," said Tommy. "You saw the deceased turning in at the gate, you say. Are you sure she was alone?"
"Oh, she was alone, all right. Nobody with her."
"And between that time and when you met us, nobody came out of the gate?"
"Not a soul."
"You'd have seen them if they had."
"Well, of course I should. Nobody came out till that wild chap did."
The Majesty of the Law moved portentously down the steps and paused by the white gatepost, which bore the imprint of a hand in red.
"Kind of amateur he must have been," he said pityingly, "to leave a thing like that."
Then he swung out into the road. It was the day after the crime. Tommy and Tuppence were still at the Grand Hotel, but Tommy had thought it prudent to discard his clerical disguise. James Riley had been apprehended and was in custody. His solicitor, Mr. Marvel, had just finished a lengthy conversation with Tommy on the subject of the crime.
"I never would have believed it of James Riley," he said simply. "He's always been a man of violent speech, but that's all."
Tommy nodded.
"If you disperse energy in speech, it doesn't leave you too much over for action. What I realize is that I shall be one of the principal witnesses against him. The conversation he had with me just before the crime was particularly damning, and in spite of everything, I like the man, and if there was anyone else to suspect, I should believe him to be innocent. What's his own story?"
The solicitor pursed his lips.
"He declares that he found her lying there dead, but that's impossible, of course. He's using the first lie that comes into his head. Because if he happened to be speaking the truth, it would mean that the garrulous Mrs. Honeycott committed the crime, and that is fantastic. Well, yes, he must have done it. But the maid heard her cry out, remember?"
"The maid, yes." Tommy was silent for a moment. Then he said thoughtfully, "What credulous creatures we are, really. We believe evidence as though it were gospel truth. And what is it really? Only the impression conveyed to the mind by the senses. And suppose they're wrong impressions?"
The lawyer shrugged his shoulders.
"Oh, we all know there are unreliable witnesses, witnesses who remember more and more as time goes on with no real intention to deceive. Well, I don't mean only that. I mean all of us. We say things that aren't really so and never know that we've done so. For instance, both you and I, without doubt, have said, sometime or other, 'There's the post,' when what we really meant was that we'd heard a double knock and the rattle of the letterbox. 9 times out of 10, we'd be right, and it would be the post, but just possibly the 10th time, it might only be a little urchin playing a joke on us. See what I mean?"
"Yes," said Mr. Marvel slowly, "but I don't see what you're driving at."
"Well, don't you?"
"Oh, I'm not so sure that I do myself, but I'm beginning to see. It's like the stick, Tuppence, you remember? One end of it pointed one way, but the other end always points the opposite way. It depends whether you get hold of it by the right end. Doors open, but they also shut. People go upstairs, but they also go downstairs. Boxes shut, but they also open."
"What do you mean?" demanded Tuppence.
"It's so ridiculously easy, really," said Tommy, "and yet it's only just come to me. How do you know when a person's come into the house? You hear the door open and bang to. And if you're expecting anyone to come in, you'll be quite sure it is them. But it might just as easily be someone going out."
"But Miss Glen didn't go out."
"No, I know she didn't, but someone else did. The murderer. But how did she get in then? She came in whilst Mrs. Honeycutt was in the kitchen talking to Ellen. They didn't hear her. Mrs. Honeycutt went back to the drawing room, wondered if her sister had come in, and began to put the clock right. And then, as she thought, she heard her come in and go upstairs. Well, what about that? The footsteps going upstairs? Well, that was Ellen, going up to draw the curtains. You remember, Mrs. Honeycutt said her sister paused before going up. That pause was just the time needed for Ellen to come out from the kitchen into the hall. She just missed seeing the murderer. But Tommy, cried Tuppence, the cry she gave, that was James Riley. Didn't you notice what a high-pitched voice he has? In moments of great emotion, men often squeal just like a woman. But the murderer, we'd have seen him. We did see him. We even stood talking to him. Do you remember the sudden way that policeman appeared? That was because he stepped out of the gate just after the mist cleared from the road. It made us jump, don't you remember? After all, though we never think of them as that, policemen are men, just like any other men. They love and they hate. They marry. I think Gilda Glenn met her husband suddenly, just outside that gate, and took him in with her to thrash the matter out. He hadn't Riley's relief of violent words, remember? He just saw red. And he had his truncheon handy. Chapter 10 The Crackler.
Tuppence, said Tommy, we shall have to move into a much larger office.
Nonsense, said Tuppence. You mustn't get swollen-headed and think you're a millionaire just because you solved two or three tuppenny-halfpenny cases with the aid of the most amazing luck.
What some call luck, others call skill.
Of course, if you really think you are Sherlock Holmes, Thorndyke, McCarty, and the brothers Oakwood all rolled into one, there's no more to be said. Personally, I would much rather have luck on my side than all the skill in the world.
Perhaps there's something in that, conceded Tommy. All the same, Tuppence, we do need a larger office.
Why?
For the classics, said Tommy.
We need several hundreds of yards of extra bookshelf if Edgar Wallace is to be properly represented.
We haven't had an Edgar Wallace case yet.
I'm afraid we never shall, said Tommy. If you notice, he never does give the amateur sleuth much of a chance. It's all stern Scotland Yard kind of stuff. The real thing, and no base counterfeit.
Albert, the office boy, appeared at the door.
Inspector Marriott to see you, he announced.
The mystery man of Scotland Yard, murmured Tommy.
The busiest of the busies, said Tuppence.
Or is it noses?
I always get mixed up between busies and noses.
The inspector advanced upon them with a beaming smile of welcome.
Well, and how are things? He asked breezily. None the worse for our little adventure the other day?
Oh, rather not, said Tuppence. Too marvellous, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know that I would describe it exactly that way myself, said Marriott cautiously.
What has brought you here today, Marriott? Asked Tommy. Not just solicitude for our nervous systems, is it?
No, said the inspector. It's work for the brilliant Mr. Blunt.
Ha! Said Tommy. Let me put my brilliant expression on.
I've come to make you a proposition, Mr. Beresford. What would you say to rounding up a really big gang?
Is there such a thing? Asked Tommy.
What do you mean, is there such a thing? Well, I always thought that gangs were confined to fiction, like master crooks and super criminals.
Well, the master crook isn't very common, agreed the inspector. But Lord bless you, sir, there's any amount of gangs knocking about.
I don't know that I should be at my best dealing with a gang, said Tommy. The amateur crime, the crime of quiet family life, that is where I flatter myself that I shine. Drama of strong domestic interest, that's the thing, with Tuppence at hand to supply all those little feminine details which are so important and so apt to be ignored by the denser male.
His eloquence was arrested abruptly as Tuppence threw a cushion at him and requested him not to talk nonsense.
"We'll have your little bit of fun, won't you, sir?" said Inspector Marriott, smiling paternally at them both. "If you'll not take offence at my saying so, it's a pleasure to see two young people enjoying life as much as you two do."
"Do we enjoy life?" said Tuppence, opening her eyes very wide. "I suppose we do. I've never thought about it before."
To return to that gang you were talking about, said Tommy. In spite of my extensive private practice, duchesses, millionaires, and all the best charwomen, I might perhaps condescend to look into the matter for you. I don't like to see Scotland Yard at fault. You'll have the Daily Mail after you before you know where you are.
As I said before, you must have your bit of fun.
Well, it's like this.
Again, he hitched his chair forward. There's any amount of forged notes going about just now. Hundreds of them. The amount of counterfeit treasury notes in circulation would surprise you. Most artistic bit of work it is. Here's one of them. He took a £1 note from his pocket and handed it to Tommy.
Looks all right, doesn't it?
Tommy examined the note with great interest.
By Jove! I'd never spot there was anything wrong with that.
No more would most people.
Now, here's a genuine one. I'll show you the differences. Very slight they are, but you'll soon learn to tell them apart. Take this magnifying glass.
At the end of 5 minutes' coaching, both Tommy and Tuppence were fairly expert.
What do you want us to do, Inspector Marriott? Asked Tuppence. Just keep our eyes open for these things?
A great deal more than that, Mrs. Beresford. I'm pinning my faith on you to get to the bottom of the matter. You see, we've discovered that the notes are being circulated from the West End. Somebody pretty high up in the social scale is doing the distributing. They're passing them the other side of the channel as well. Now, there's a certain person who is interesting us very much. A Major Laidlaw. Perhaps you've heard the name.
I think I have, said Tommy. Connected with racing, isn't that it?
Yes. Major Laidlaw is pretty well known in connection with the turf. There's nothing actually against him, but there's a general impression that he's been a bit too smart over one or two rather shady transactions. Men in the know look queer when he's mentioned. Nobody knows much of his past or where he came from. He's got a very attractive French wife who's seen about everywhere with a train of admirers. They must spend a lot of money, the Laidlaws, and I'd like to know where it comes from.
Possibly from the train of admirers, suggested Tommy.
Well, that's the general idea, but I'm not so sure. It may be a coincidence, but a lot of notes have been forthcoming from a certain very smart little gambling club, which is much frequented by the Laidlaws and their set. This racing, gambling set get rid of a lot of loose money in notes. There couldn't be a better way of getting it into circulation.
And where do we come in?
This way. Young St. Vincent and his wife are friends of yours, I understand. They're pretty thick with the Laidlaw set, though not as thick as they were. Through them, it will be easy for you to get a footing in the same set in a way that none of our people could attempt. There's no likelihood of their spotting you. You'll have an ideal opportunity.
But what have we got to find out exactly?
Where they get the stuff from.
If they are passing it.
Quite so, said Tommy.
Major Laidlaw goes out with an empty suitcase. When he returns, it's crammed to the bursting point with treasury notes.
How's it done?
I sleuth him and find out. Is that the idea?
More or less.
But don't neglect the lady and her father, Mr. Herulard. Remember, the notes are being passed on both sides of the channel.
My dear Marriott, exclaimed Tommy reproachfully, Blunt's brilliant detectives do not know the meaning of the word neglect.
The inspector rose.
Well, good luck to you, he said, and departed.
Slush, said Tuppence enthusiastically.
Eh? Said Tommy, perplexed.
Counterfeit money, explained Tuppence. It's always called slush.
I know I'm right.
Oh, Tommy, we've got an Edgar Wallace case. At last, we are busies.
We are, said Tommy, and we are out to get the crackler, and we will get him good.
Did you say the cackler or the crackler?
The crackler.
Oh, what is a crackler?
A new word that I've coined, said Tommy, descriptive of one who passes false notes into circulation. Banknotes crackle, therefore he is called a crackler. Nothing could be more simple.
That's rather a good idea, said Tuppence. It makes it seem more real.
I like the rustler myself, much more descriptive and sinister.
No, said Tommy. I said crackler first, and I stick to it.
I shall enjoy this case, said Tuppence. Lots of nightclubs and cocktails in it. I shall buy some eyelash black tomorrow.
Well, your eyelashes are black already, objected her husband.
I could make them blacker, said Tuppence. And cherry lipstick would be useful too, that ultra-bright kind.
Tuppence, said Tommy.
You're a real rake at heart. What a good thing it is that you're married to a sober, steady, middle-aged man like myself.
You wait, said Tuppence. When you have been to the Python Club a bit, you won't be so sober yourself.
Tommy produced from a cupboard various bottles, two glasses, and a cocktail shaker.
Let's start now, he said. We're after you, Crackler, and we mean to get you.
Making the acquaintance of the Laidlaws proved an easy affair. Tommy and Tuppence, young, well-dressed, eager for life, and with apparently money to burn, were soon made free of that particular coterie in which the Laidlaws had their being. Major Laidlaw was a tall, fair man, typically English in appearance, with a hearty, sportsmanlike manner, slightly belied by the hard lines round his eyes and the occasional quick sideways glance that assorted oddly with his supposed character. He was a very dexterous card player, and Tommy noticed that when the stakes were high, he seldom rose from a table a loser. Marguerite Laidlaw was quite a different proposition. She was a charming creature, with the slenderness of a wood nymph and the face of a Greuze picture. Her dainty broken English was fascinating, and Tommy felt that it was no wonder most men were her slaves. She seemed to take a great fancy to Tommy from the first, and playing his part, he allowed himself to be swept into her train.
"My Tommy," she would say, "but positively I cannot go without my Tommy. His hair, it is the colour of the sunset, is it not?"
Her father was a more sinister figure, very correct, very upright, with his little black beard and his watchful eyes. Tuppence was the first to report progress. She came to Tommy with 10 1-pound notes.
"Have a look at these. They're wrong ones, aren't they?"
Tommy examined them and confirmed Tuppence's diagnosis. "Where did you get them from?"
"That boy, Jimmy Faulkner. Marguerite Laidlaw gave them to him to put on a horse for her. I said I wanted small notes and gave him a tenner in exchange."
"All new and crisp," said Tommy thoughtfully. "They can't have passed through many hands. I suppose young Faulkner is all right."
"Jimmy? Oh, he's a dear. He and I are becoming great friends."
"So I've noticed," said Tommy coldly. "Do you really think it is necessary?"
"Oh, it isn't business," said Tuppence cheerfully. "It's pleasure. He's such a nice boy. I'm glad to get him out of that woman's clutches. You've no idea of the amount of money she's cost him.
It looks to me as though he were getting rather a pash for you, Tuppence."
"I've thought the same myself sometimes. It's nice to know one's still young and attractive, isn't it?
Your moral tone, Tuppence, is deplorably low. You look at these things from the wrong point of view."
"I haven't enjoyed myself so much for years," declared Tuppence shamelessly. "And anyway, what about you? Do I ever see you nowadays? Aren't you always living in Marguerite Laidlaw's pocket?"
"Business," said Tommy crisply.
"But she is attractive, isn't she?"
"Not my type," said Tommy. "I don't admire her."
"Liar," laughed Tuppence. "But I always did think I'd rather marry a liar than a fool."
"I suppose," said Tommy, "that there's no absolute necessity for a husband to be either." But Tuppence merely threw him a pitying glance and withdrew. Amongst Mrs. Laidlaw's train of admirers was a simple but extremely wealthy gentleman of the name of Hank Ryder. Mr. Ryder came from Alabama, and from the first he was disposed to make a friend and confidant of Tommy.
"That's a wonderful woman, sir," said Mr. Ryder,
following the lovely Marguerite with reverential eyes.
"Plumb full of civilization. Can't beat La Gay France, can you? When I'm near her, I feel as though I was one of the Almighty's earliest experiments. I guess he'd got to get his hand in before he attempted anything so lovely as that perfectly lovely woman."
Tommy agreeing politely with these sentiments, Mr. Ryder unburdened himself still further.
"Seems kind of a shame a lovely creature like that should have money worries."
"Has she?" asked Tommy.
"You bet your life she has. Queer fish, Laidlaw. She's scared of him. Told me so. Daren't tell him about her little bills."
"Are they little bills?" asked Tommy.
"Well, when I say little, after all, a woman's got to wear clothes. And the less there are of them, the more they cost, the way I figure it out. And a pretty woman like that doesn't want to go about in last season's goods. Cards, too. The poor little thing's been mighty unlucky at cards. Why, she lost 50 to me last night."
"Well, she won 200 from Jimmy Faulkner the night before," said Tommy dryly.
"Did she, indeed? That relieves my mind some. By the way, there seems to be a lot of dud notes floating around in your country just now. I paid in a bunch at my bank this morning. 25 of them were down and outers.
so the polite gentleman behind the counter informed me. Well, that's rather a large proportion. Were they new-looking? New and crisp as they make 'em. Why, they were the ones Mrs. Laidlaw paid over to me, I reckon. Wonder where she got 'em from. One of these toughs on the race course, as likely as not. Yes, said Tommy, very likely. You know, Mr. Beresford, I'm new to this sort of high life. All these swell dames and the rest of the outfit. Only made my pile a short while back. Came right over to Europe to see life. Tommy nodded. He made a mental note to the effect that, with the aid of Marguerite Laidlaw, Mr. Ryder would probably see a good deal of life, and that the price charged would be heavy. Meantime, for the second time, he had evidence that the forged notes were being distributed pretty near at hand, and that in all probability Marguerite Laidlaw had a hand in their distribution. On the following night, he himself was given a proof. It was at that small select meeting place mentioned by Inspector Marriott. There was dancing there, but the real attraction of the place lay behind a pair of imposing folding doors. There were two rooms there, with green, baize-covered tables, where vast sums changed hands nightly. Marguerite Laidlaw, rising at last to go, thrust a quantity of small notes into Tommy's hands.
They are so bulky, Tommy. You will change them, yes? A big note. See my so sweet little bag? It bulges him to distraction.
Tommy brought her the £100 note she asked for. Then, in a quiet corner, he examined the notes she had given him. At least a quarter of them were counterfeit. But where did she get her supplies from? To that, he had as yet no answer. By means of Albert's cooperation, he was almost sure that Laidlaw was not the man. His movements had been watched closely and had yielded no result. Tommy suspected her father, the saturnine Monsieur Eroulade. He went to and fro to France fairly often. What could be simpler than to bring the notes across with him? A false bottom to the trunk, something of that kind. Tommy strolled slowly out of the club, absorbed in these thoughts, but was suddenly recalled to immediate necessities. Outside in the street was Mr. Hank P. Ryder, and it was clear at once that Mr. Ryder was not strictly sober. At the moment he was trying to hang his hat on the radiator of a car, and missing it by some inches every time.
"This goddarn hat stand! This goddarn hat stand!" said Mr. Ryder tearfully. "Locked like that in the States. Man can hang up his hat every night, sir. You're wearing two hats. Never seen a man wearing two hats before. It must be the effect of the climate."
"Perhaps I've got two heads," said Tommy gravely.
"Sure you have," said Mr. Ryder. "That's odd. That's a remarkable fact. Let's have a cocktail. Prohibition, prohibition, that's what's done me in. I guess I'm drunk. Constitutionally drunk. Cocktails, mixed them. Angel's kiss, that's Marguerite, lovely creature. Fun of me, too. Horse's neck. Two martinis, three roads to ruins, no roads to ruins. I mixed them all in a beer tankard. Bet me I wouldn't. I said, to hell, I said..."
Tommy interrupted. "That's all right," he said soothingly. "Now, what about getting home?"
"No home to go to,"
said Mr. Ryder sadly, and wept. "What hotel are you staying at?" asked Tommy.
"Can't go home," said Mr. Ryder. "Treasure hunt. Swell thing to do. She did it. Whitechapel. White hearts. White heads and sorrow to the grave."
But Mr. Ryder became suddenly dignified. He drew himself erect and attained a sudden miraculous command over his speech.
"Young man, I'm telling you, Margie took me in her car. Treasure hunting. English aristocracy. I'll do it. Under the cobblestones. £500. Sound thought. 'Tis a sound thought, I'm telling you, young man. You've been kind to me. I've got your welfare at heart, sir. At heart. We Americans..."
Tommy interrupted him this time with even less ceremony. "What's that you say? Mrs. Laidlaw took you in a car?" The American nodded with a kind of owlish solemnity. "To Whitechapel?" Again that owlish nod. "And you found £500 there?"
Mr. Ryder struggled for words.
She did,
he corrected his questioner.
Left me outside the door. Always left outside, it's kind of sad, always outside.
Would you know your way there?
Well, I guess so. Hank Ryder doesn't lose his bearings.
Tommy hauled him along unceremoniously. He found his own car where it was waiting, and presently they were bowling eastward. The cool air revived Mr. Ryder. After slumping against Tommy's shoulder in a kind of stupor, he awoke, clear-headed and refreshed.
"Say, boy, where are we?" he demanded.
"Whitechapel," said Tommy crisply. "Is this where you came with Mrs. Laidlaw tonight?"
Looks kind of familiar," admitted Mr. Ryder, looking round. Seems to me we turned off to the left somewhere down here.
That's it. That street there.
Tommy turned off obediently. Mr. Ryder issued directions.
That's it. Sure, yeah, round to the right.
Say, aren't the smells awful?
Yes, past that pub at the corner. Sharp round and stop at the mouth of that little alley.
Well, what's the big idea?
Hand it to me. Some of the youth left behind? Are we going to put one over on them?
That's it exactly, said Tommy. We're going to put one over on them.
Rather a joke, isn't it? I'll tell the world, assented Mr. Ryder. Though I'm just a mite hazed about it all, he ended wistfully.
Tommy got out and assisted Mr. Ryder to alight also. They advanced into the alleyway. On the left were the backs of a row of dilapidated houses, most of which had doors opening into the alley. Mr. Ryder came to a stop before one of these doors.
"In here she went," he declared. "It was this door, I'm plumb certain of it."
"Well, they all look very alike," said Tommy. "Reminds me of the story of the soldier and the princess. You remember? They made a cross on the door to show which one it was. Shall we do the same?" Laughing, he drew a piece of white chalk from his pocket and made a rough cross low down on the door. Then he looked up at various dim shapes that prowled high on the walls of the alley, one of which was uttering a blood-curdling yawl. "Lots of cats about," he remarked cheerfully.
"What is the procedure?" asked Mr. Ryder. "Do we step inside?"
"Adopting due precautions, we do," said Tommy. He glanced up and down the alleyway, then softly tried the door. It yielded. He pushed it open and peered into a dim yard. Noiselessly he passed through, Mr. Ryder on his heels.
"Gee," said the latter, "there's someone coming down the alley."
He slipped outside again. Tommy stood still for a minute, then, hearing nothing, went on. He took a torch from his pocket and switched on the light for a brief second. That momentary flash enabled him to see his way ahead. He pushed forward and tried the closed door ahead of him. That too gave, and very softly he pushed it open and went in. After standing still a second and listening, he again switched on the torch, and at that flash, as though at a given signal, the place seemed to rise round him. Two men were in front of him, two men were behind him. They closed in on him and bore him down.
"Lights!" growled a voice.
An incandescent gas burner was lit. By its light, Tommy saw a circle of unpleasing faces. His eyes wandered gently round the room and noted some of the objects in it.
"Ah," he said pleasantly. "The headquarters of the counterfeiting industry, if I'm not mistaken."
"Shut your jaw," growled one of the men.
The door opened and shut behind Tommy, and a genial and well-known voice spoke.
"Got him, boys. That's right. Now, Mr. Busy, let me tell you, you're up against it."
"That dear old word," said Tommy, "how it thrills me. Yes, I am the mystery man of Scotland Yard. Why, it's Mr. Hank Ryder. This is a surprise.
I guess you mean that, too. I've been laughing fit to bust all this evening, leading you here like a little child. And you so pleased with your cleverness. Why, sonny, I was on to you from the start. You weren't in with that crowd for your health. I'll let you play about for a while, and when you got real suspicious of the lovely Marguerite, I said to myself, now's the time to lead him to it. I guess your friends won't be hearing of you for some time. Going to do me in?
That's the correct expression, I believe. You have got it in for me. You've got a nerve, all right. No, we shan't attempt violence. Just keep you under restraint, so to speak. I'm afraid you're backing the wrong horse, said Tommy. I've no intention of being kept under restraint, as you call it. Mr. Ryder smiled genially. From outside, a cat uttered a melancholy cry to the moon. Banking on that cross you put on the door, eh, sonny? Said Mr. Ryder. I shouldn't if I were you, because I know that story you mentioned, heard it when I was a little boy. I stepped back into the alleyway to enact the part of the dog with eyes as big as cartwheels. If you were in that alley now, you would observe that every door in the alley is marked with an identical cross. Tommy dropped his head despondently. Thought you were mighty clever, didn't you? Said Ryder. As the words left his lips, a sharp rapping sounded on the door. What's that? He cried, starting. At the same time, an assault began on the front of the house. The door at the back was a flimsy affair. The lock gave almost immediately, and Inspector Marriott showed in the doorway. Well done, Marriott, said Tommy. You were quite right as to the district. I'd like you to make the acquaintance of Mr. Hank Ryder, who knows all the best fairy tales. You see, Mr. Ryder, he added gently, I've had my suspicions of you. Albert, that important-looking boy with the big ears, is Albert, had orders to follow on his motorcycle if you and I went off joyriding at any time. And whilst I was ostentatiously marking a chalk cross on the door to engage your attention, I also emptied a little bottle of valerian on the ground. Nasty smell, but cats love it. All the cats in the neighbourhood were assembled outside to mark the right house when Albert and the police arrived. He looked at the dumbfounded Mr. Ryder with a smile, then rose to his feet. I said I would get you, Crackler, and I have got you, he observed. What the hell are you talking about? Asked Mr. Ryder. What do you mean, Crackler? You will find it in the glossary of the next criminal dictionary, said Tommy. Etymology, doubtful. He looked round him with a happy smile. And all down without a nose, he murmured brightly. Good night, Marriott. I must go now to where the happy ending of the story awaits me. No reward like the love of a good woman, and the love of a good woman awaits me at home. That is, I hope it does, but one never knows nowadays. This has been a very dangerous job, Marriott. Do you know Captain Jimmy Faulkner? His dancing is simply too marvellous, and as for his taste in cocktails... Yes, Marriott, it has been a very dangerous job.